She said you, every kind and size, in front of this crowd, I make a fool out of you, make you a coward, leave you when you cry. Stop me, I leave you today, the same as dead. I'll step on you, get you excited, and leave you confused. Today I'll make you give up your career, leaving just dust to take up your space. I'll wrench out your arm, put you on the dish, I'll kill you with sticks. Today I'll kick you, my foot in your throat, put you to the rope. Head of a donkey, I'll take you after to the slaughter, I'll step on your belly. If you play bridge, I will play chess. If you play cards, I'll play backgammon. If you make love, I'll read a book. Always when you're down, I'm very up. Always when you're high, I feel so mellow. You like to walk, but I like the car. You want a dog, but I like a cat. You like to eat, but I prefer to drink. You like to love, but I prefer to sleep. If I respect you, even if you're sick. If you could write, I would not read. If you could draw, I would not look. If you could sing, I would not listen. If you could dance, I would sit down. I don't respect you, even if you're sick. If you would die, perhaps I would cry. If you were married,
Frisbee, finishing today's program. Great Swedish post-punk and synthwave comp called Life in the Future, Swedish post-punk and synthwave, 1979-1987. I Throw Punches, name of the track, from Frisbee. That preceded by music from Luger. You can get it on the Free Music Archive. I'll put a direct link to it on the playlist page. It's called Concrete Light. Track we heard called Shirakovsky Palisade 2. That was preceded by music from a great, super limited compilation of Christchurch, New Zealand music from 1981 to 1987 called Krypton 10. The band, the Magooans, the song Arson, the Flames of Passion. Before that, Rheingold from 1980, Rendezvous, the name of the track, self-titled thing, out of Germany. Coming out of the Cars, It's All I Can Do, from the Wild and Woolly WFMU MP3 library. Preceding the Cars was stuff from Martin DuPont, 1984's Hot Paradox record, and the song of the same name. Alias before that, the CD is Fever Dream, the song Boom Boom Boom. And we open that set with music from Swara Samrat. Lottery of Memories, name of the record from 1980. Walking on the Beach, the song we heard. That's everything we heard. My name's Scott. See you on Sunday at the Atlantic Annick. See you next Monday on the radio. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker, Too Much Information, is next. Freeform Radio, WFMU, Uni Stars, WMFU, Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. Bye-bye.
I was coming out of becoming a dad for the first time, and anyone, you know, who has children and goes through that knows there's quite a bit of an adjustment period, especially when you're used to going out and doing whatever you want. So the kid came along, and all of a sudden my social life just did a complete belly flop and then drowned at the bottom of the pool.
Hal Niedvieski is a writer who lives and works in Toronto. Thanks to his newborn, he found himself housebound. But it wasn't all just diapers and baby food. He wrote a book that year called The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. Hal's thesis is that we're completely remaking our world using online social media. The book ends with Hal trying to milk his online social network to restart his real-world social life.
I had this idea that I needed to revitalize my social life, have a kind of a coming out party for myself, that I was back in town, back in action, you know, after that first year of fatherhood. I realized that I was doing very little socializing in real life over this year, I had managed to acquire some 500 Facebook friends, and This could be a, you know, in my mind, this was a potential source for new friendships. So I invited all my Facebook friends to a local bar, and I said, you know, I'll buy the first round. This is the Hal Needs New Friends evening, and come on down. I sent this out on Facebook, and for those of us familiar with Facebook, there are three responses that you can give to an event. You can say yes, you can say no, you can say maybe, or you can just ignore it altogether. So I ended up having, I think, about 40 people say yes, about 100 say maybe, and the rest saying either no or ignoring it altogether. So I thought to myself, okay, this sounds good. You know, this is shaping up nicely. This is looking like 50 or so people are going to come to my party. So I called the bar and let them know what was going on, and put on a new shirt, splashed on my man perfume, and down I went to the bar to meet the new friends of Hal. The only problem was that only one person came to my event, Paula, who's a lovely person, and it was nice that she came, except that she, I think, was a little weirded out by the fact that she was the only person at the Hal Needs New Friends party, and she only stayed for about 20 minutes.
It's pretty well documented. I was the second guy on the internet. There was Al Gore, and he was doing crazy stuff. Groups, alt, I never went there. I actually made one of the first web pages. It was updated daily. PeterChoice.com, all the news you need to know about me, updated daily. Before the word blog entered the parlance of the web, I was one of the first blogs. It had to have been one of the first 10 blogs. The first web pages like mine used to be free of a format. They were all different. You would click on one picture and not know where you would go. It was supposed to be like a fun house. And it was a loose structure, but it kept getting bigger and bigger, and then I had to rename things because I didn't think of putting it in this tidy little archive thing like 1998 stories, 1997 stories. I just put them together in like stories about death, stories where I get in trouble. Well, I was really just writing stuff that was just pouring out of me. I had to get all of this stuff out. And I also posted like nude pictures. Remember, I had the nude gallery? And I was getting a lot of hits. One of my best features, most popular one, was called Nightmare in the FM. It was my personal story about how I got fired from this radio station. Back in the old days, I would get fired from all these jobs, and I had nothing to do but feel bad about it, about myself. But here I was empowered, and it was a new form of media. So if you are rotten to someone, someone can put up a web page. I was one of the first guys to do that. But, you know, I didn't want it to look like the revenge site. What I wanted to do was be a voice in the new media. I was doing this because instead of being a passive reader or a viewer of other people's material, now I was excited to be the creator. I was the one putting the ideas forth. So it was a big thrill back then. I actually used to think, when I was riding my bike around town, that I'd better get home and update my web, because I bet everyone's reading it right now. I bet everyone in these houses is watching peterschoice.com. I had sections on my website, like it was called The Dark Truth, My Life Story, and I'd always add to it and subtract from it. It kind of was a big thorn inside of my family, because everybody read it. There was a page I put up about the death of my father, and I wanted to put a picture of him in his open casket. I thought it was a good picture, but the only time I actually followed someone's advice, my Aunt Betty told me not to, so I didn't. I just put the picture of the closed casket. My father, actually, he was a brilliant man. We kids didn't know this, but he worked on cellular technology in the 50s, basically inventing the cell phone. But he couldn't talk into an answering machine. He was a total Luddite about like new products and things. So he was a contradiction. So when the computers started to just be the only thing that they would talk about in the early 90s, about what's coming, what's happening there, I decided I had to get behind the new media because of my father. When I met somebody, I would go over to the nearest computer. By then, they were everywhere, in the library, wherever you were. And I'd type in peterschoice.com. And they'd be so impressed. But I didn't know how to do these tabs, search functions. And I was always beating my head against the big monitor because of the help function. The help, I could never put in my question, like, where did the page go? Do you remember that about the web in the early days? And there was no way to hit the back button. It just disappeared. And, you know, you'd cry. I knew I couldn't learn. It was all about inviting the proper people over, paying people even to, like, help me. But everybody that really knew the stuff where the internet was growing into what it is now, with the web pages being totally with video and interactive stuff, they kept that a secret to themselves. It was like a secret. It's not in anyone's interest to help you make a great site. I would go to the library after I spent 20 hours updating and making new pieces, and it would be wrong. Remember that? You would look at the page on another computer, and it would come in all fuzzy and weird and upside down, and that would drive me mad. That's when I first started to go crazy. And as an artist, I was so embarrassed, because that's not what I wanted it to look like. And that's the way it is now. If you go to that waybackmachine.com, it's in fragments. I was lucky that I was able to upload audio, because someone came over one day and we put some pieces up that were very good. Me yelling on other radio host shows. But it was frustrating for me. Because every time I sat down at that computer, every day I turn it on and there's something new I couldn't figure out. I couldn't just sit there doing what I know and getting to the creative process. The creative process I was really good at, telling the story, telling real funny stories, telling wicked stories, challenging people, being, you know, challenging the status quo, doing my politics, trying to be inspirational. And I also posted, like, nude pictures. Remember I had the nude gallery? I was trying not to be too esoteric, but things were pretty much written like song lyrics, stanzas. I wasn't writing like a newspaper reporter or the way that they write now, straight ahead. I was trying a style of my own that was different than the way I spoke, a little different than the way I spoke on the air, but the similar aesthetic I wanted to translate to this new media. And I had this theory that these embarrassing things that I used to not tell people, if it's embarrassing, put it up, write about it. So I thought I was being cathartic. I thought I was working through my problems. I was being my own psychologist. I think I was a little afraid of the interactive part. I would post emails that were negative, and I would look for them. There weren't that many. But I didn't want people to have free access because I was fighting with so many people. I didn't want them to, a message board that was just calling me all sorts of names. But now I'm thinking about it. I put myself out there. No one could have exposed me. It's like the David Letterman thing. I was coming clean about things people didn't even want to know about. It was too much information. PeterChoice.com lasted until I moved to Los Angeles. And when I moved to Los Angeles, I had so many new things to write about. I was on the set. I was on movies. I'd never been in movies and TV shows. However, I had to stop it then because somebody got fired from Deadwood by just posting on a public site some kind of gossip. And I realized that I didn't want to screw things up with my new Hollywood thing. Also, it was never celebrity geared. I don't care about celebrities other than myself. I was making myself a celebrity. That's why I was doing it. I was trying to be an artist. Someone asked me the other day, what's your occupation? I just say artist now, not actor. Then you sound like a retard. My website ended on a day that I didn't know it would end. It was just the day they cut me off because I wasn't paying the bill to West Coast. And the last day was about how I was depressed, miserable, I can't find a job. And I was actually using the webpage like a tin cup. Can somebody, like I must have many fans, maybe someone will send me money. So it ends on a really bad note that I'm not proud. It wasn't a great page. Out of all the pages I made that were so nice, so clever, the Wayback Machine has that page.
I'm Jessica Schrader, and I write the blog What I Wore, where I photograph myself on an almost daily basis and share the what, when, why of how I put together my outfit. And along with that, try and give a little style advice to other women trying to feel their best about how they look. Sometimes I will be in public at a restaurant or on the train or walking down the street, and someone will recognize me. It's really flattering, and it's kind of cool, but sometimes I'm in the middle of a very important conversation with my fiance, or I'm with a friend who doesn't get this whole online thing, and it's very kind of weird to them. I hope it doesn't get too much more invasive than it already has. I mean, I love sharing everything about my life. I mean, I'm on the internet in four places, so it's a great thing for me, but What I Wore being a fashion-based thing, I can kind of cut it off and say, this isn't really fashion-related. I don't feel like I need to tell you about that. But when it's like, here's my life, then it's, you know, where's the end of how much your readers are going to ask from you? And it's only recently that I've decided, after having conversations with friends who don't want to be included, that it was time to carefully back up. And not in a really, really noticeable way, but, you know, some details are just off limits. I just didn't feel like I wanted to tell anyone what my wedding dress looked like until I actually wore it. Because I didn't really want the criticism. I didn't really want any applause either. I just wanted to let that be a personal thing about my life. I recently asked my commenters to behave like they would in real life. So you probably would not walk up to someone and say, I don't like your outfit. Sorry, sweetie. And I don't think any of them would come up to me and say that to my face. But behind this wall of anonymity, people feel like it's okay to say that. And they say, well, you're putting it out there for everyone to see. And that's true, I am. But I'm also putting it out there like, hey, friend, check out what I wore. What did you wear today? Or, you know, it's kind of like this personal thing. So all of a sudden people are saying, oh, be professional, take this criticism. But I'm saying, I was never professional. I was always your friend. Why are you all of a sudden treating me like this? I'm just like a regular girl. Sometimes I think, oh, I'm giving this up. I need a vacation. And every time I try and take a break, I don't. I just can't. There's something compulsive about documenting my life and getting feedback on it, positive feedback. Those, you know, feedback tools help my self-esteem. And so I don't know if I could totally vanish from the internet. I think I'll stop blogging so much in my life when my fiance and I decide to have children. We've already discussed that we don't want their names to be public or their faces until they're old enough to want to do it.
When you bring a child into your life, a lot of it is about growth. You know, a lot of it's about change and having somebody that's more important than you, that you want to take care of and teach and show, and then you can all grow as a family together. And so we were missing that. That was the one thing. So after a couple of years of different treatments and things that weren't going anywhere, we decided to adopt. And we were matched up with somebody who was, you know, a great birth mom, and everything was coming together. Coincidentally, a friend of mine at work, you know, this guy that I'd really bonded with through all of these just, you know, horrendous projects, you know, through all that pain, he was going through the same thing at home, and he went through a different route. He went international, so he was adopting from China. We were adopting from you know, down south. And at the same time, my old high school buddy Jason was also having a child. He was, you know, doing it the old-fashioned way, you know, which, you know, that was all right. We didn't hold that against him, but it was, you know, with the three of us one night decided to all go out because we were all about to become fathers, and it was really exciting. It was a really exciting time for our lives. Matt pulls out a picture of Olive, is the daughter that he's going to be adopting from China in a couple months. And he was really excited and was showing it all, and she looked really cute. And they explained that he had already set up a Gmail account for her. You know, I mean, she's 3 months, you know, not even in the country yet, and he's already thinking about a Gmail account. So I just laid into him. You know, what you really need is a Twitter account for your new baby. And right there, something clicked. We all just looked at each other and said, wait a minute. You've got all of these anxious first-time parents. They don't want to miss anything. They don't want anybody to think that they're bad parents. So they're always watching the baby monitor, and, you know, any time that they're doing anything for themselves, they're feeling guilty. So what our site was going to be was you hook up that baby monitor, throw in some baby speech recognition to make it a little extra sexy, and you put it out on Twitter. So wherever you are, you're constantly engaged in your kid's life. Baby says goo, it goes out on Twitter, you find out about it, and grandma can play too. We're going to call it Baby Talk. And it was just brilliant. It was just this million-dollar idea. Quitting your job, you know, it takes a little bit of risk. But we were all willing to do that. And, you know, oddly enough, our wives were also, you know, also had jobs, so they were willing to support it. So we bundled up all of our ideas, and we hit the road. And we started raising money. We started calling it Parenting 2.0. People like that, you know, that all of a sudden they'd start nodding their heads. And once they started nodding their heads, then, you know, we knew we had them. One of Matt's uncles cashed out part of his pension fund, you know, because he really believed in us. You know, he really believed that Matt was the smartest nephew that he'd ever known. And You know, he gave us about $20,000, and we got another $10,000 from my aunt. And, you know, it wasn't enough to pull a salary for any of us. It was just enough to buy some servers and hire a Chinese programmer who could help us with some of the hard parts. So we set up shop in Matt's basement. Jason was busy making phone calls, you know, trying to line things up, trying to line up deals. I was writing code. We had our other guy, Hee Jung, who was our Chinese programmer, was working with us. And we never had enough time. We were always about to expire. When you're working on that seed money and you can see that your runway, you know, the amount of time you have before your thing has to take off, when your runway is so short, you don't have a lot of time to debate stuff or think about anything. You just have to go. And plus, you know, three of us had the other clock of we're all about to become dads. And, you know, we're sleep deprived already. But, you know, when Junior arrives, we're not getting any sleep at all. We're just going to be changing diapers. So one night, Jason comes in and says, I've got some bad news, some good news, and a little more bad news. I say, all right, well, what's going on? He says, we're never going to make it. I ran the numbers. We will never be able to finish this in time. You know, I said, all right, that sounds pretty bad. What's the good news? He said, well, I found this site that's on the auction block right now called chattytype.com. It was a kids interactive play session thing, and I think we could buy them real cheap, and we could easily reconfigure that for babies. There was one more piece of bad news. We had to fire Hee Jung, and I had to do it because Matt didn't want to run into him when he was going to China. So after the acquisition, it was our first chance to really go through what we had bought, and I was looking through all the code and looking at the database, and it wasn't what we thought we bought. It was something else. And I called over Matt and Jason and showed them what I found, and right there we knew it was over. It was done.
Can you elaborate? Talk about what you found?
I can't get into it. I mean, we owned this for a period of time, and we lost our shirts on it. And I don't want to wind up on the sex offender registry.
I'm not saying you have to go into it. Just say that you found kitty porn.
Beep that out. You're going to have to beep that out.
John, what is wrong with you?
I'm in the middle of adopting.
John, you said we could record the story about what happened to Baby Talk, your startup.
I'm telling you the whole story. The point is, if you're going to go out on the internet thinking that you're going to find this big gold mine, you're not. You're going to find something else.
I think I'm tired of the blog. It stopped nourishing me. I wasn't enjoying it anymore. I found that the only way to get to up the readership was to talk about things I wasn't interested in, to create controversies about things that don't matter, stupid comic book arguments, and I was fed up with it.
When I called cartoonist Eddie Campbell, his blog hadn't been updated for over 3 months. Clearly, he'd lost interest. Because when he started it a few years back, there were links and daily updates. But I'm not calling him a slacker. It's not like he doesn't have anything else to do. This month sees the release of The Years Have Pants, a 640-page collection of Eddie Campbell's Alec stories from Top Shelf Comics. Eddie Campbell first drew Alec McGarry 30 years ago. He was Eddie's alter ego. And over the years, Alec and Eddie have gone from working in warehouses and crawling pubs to marriage and kids. Both have become successful comic artists. Eddie Campbell did the drawings for Alan Moore's From Hell, which got turned into a bad movie, but it did provide the necessary funds for Eddie and Alec to buy a house in Australia, where they both live. Eventually, Alec McGarry sort of becomes Eddie Campbell. You can witness this in the later part of the book, but we're never really sure if the Eddie on the page is the one doing the drawing. You see, Eddie Campbell was doing autobiographical comics long before this kind of work had a name. And there's something so unique about what he does, his work stands apart from the very genre he helped inspire. Eddie Campbell set out not so much to document his life, but to tell a true story. I'm so pleased he had a few moments to talk with me about his work and his approach to telling stories about real life.
I wanted to tell the story of my times as I saw it. I hadn't really worked out that I would be the central figure in it. I hadn't completely rationalized that at the time. I didn't think that my own story was any more interesting than anybody else's. But inevitably, if you're telling the story of what you know, you're going to be the pivot, the central point of view in the story. And so it turns out being a pictorial autobiography, I suppose, but that wasn't the intention.
Did having a stand-in like Alec give you more license to mythologize?
I don't really always feel personally attached to the stuff that I've drawn. It's almost like it happened to somebody else. I find it just as easy to talk about Eddie Campbell in the third person when that time came along. We're dealing with matters of fiction, where you fictionalize the stuff of your own life. You create a fictional version of yourself. So there's a fictional Eddie Campbell that's not the same person as me. He's closer to the fictional Alec McGarry than either of them are to the real Eddie Campbell. All of this is very complicated, and you can create a conundrum that revolves around forever and ever, and you can never get off the roundabout. I think the business of organizing material into stories is fiction, even if the stories originate in real life. The opposite of fiction is non-fiction. The opposite of fiction is not fact.
I'd like to maybe look back to some of the early stuff in the collection here. I'm thinking that there's, you know, you have many different ways of telling stories, but I'd like to kind of focus on two. There's these larger narratives like Graffiti Kitchen and the King Canute Crowd, but then there's also these amazing one or two page fragment slice of life type forms, and they're very different.
The difference there is the difference between telling a story that happened some time ago, which is all complete with a beginning and an end, and the anecdotal style of telling what happened yesterday, what happened last night, and those are the one-page things. They're not woven into a bigger narrative because I'm recording it on the run.
I'm wondering how those two distinct ways of telling stories, you know, worked for you, complemented each other. Because you were working on them both sort of simultaneously, no?
Yeah, I was, yeah. They're definitely two separate modes. And most of the mythologizing tends to take part in the kind of story where I've had time to think about it, to sift the details and organize them in according to the rules of fiction. And very often I'm doing that, but deliberately making it look as though I'm not doing that. I'm making it look like I'm telling an offhand anecdotal story, but I'm usually cunningly casting an eye down to the end of the road where the thing is leading. The thing I'm always trying to avoid is an over-finished image. Something that sometimes a picture looks truer if it's more immediate.
Yeah.
The business of once you introduce the techniques of finishing a picture, you're into an area of falsehood, of lying, of pretending. Very often the spontaneous image is truer. And then again, sometimes that also can be a lie. It only looks truer because it's spontaneous.
It seems like you could take that back to what you just said about these moments on the run, you know, that artifice of connecting them together more in a plot way can kind of ring false, and maybe that's why these anecdotal pieces that, you know, make up so much of so much great work and such a great section of the whole omnibus. Maybe that's why they work so well.
Yeah, yeah. That's another thing. I wish we hadn't called it an omnibus. An omnibus to me is a collection of disparate things. And I think we'd stuck that title on it before I really realized what an integrated piece of work it was going to be. It took me a while. To realize when I was actually organizing the material that there was the possibility of arranging it in chronological order, as though it had been conceived of a piece that appeared to me while I had the stuff on the desktop. I thought, well, that's interesting. I could arrange this so that these characters appear to age from page 1 to page 640. So you've got a dark-haired Alec McGarry at the beginning, and by 600 pages later, he's got a mop of gray hair. And you can see it evolving gradually. Yeah. Somebody the other day, in one of my other interviews, said that the fact of these 640 pages spanning 30 years of time unintentionally created an effect of sadness, because we don't really want to see time disappearing that quickly. We don't really want to contemplate our mortality. One of the themes in the book is the memento mori, the reminder that life is short and we're all going to die. And I hadn't even realized that this was an obsessive theme of mine until I arranged the material and I thought, gee, I keep this idea keeps cropping up.
So coming back to you and Alec, then, I'd like for you to sort of tell us the story of how they merge, if you wouldn't mind, like from the perspective of the creator. Was this an easy transition for you when Alec and Eddie sort of became one?
Well, I just started using my own name. Somebody writing a review of the Snooter pointed out that there's a panel in the Snooter where I say that the Snooter is an insect, it's a moth, I think, that flew through my window in 1994, and it bit me on the hand, and I had this strange rash that developed overnight. And in the fiction of the book, I've said that this was my wake-up call, and it was a moment of change in my life in which I became another person. And some astute reviewer noted that was the point at which I started using the name Eddie Campbell as to replace Alec McGarry. And I hadn't actually realized that. I was totally subconscious. It was the moment in which my midlife crisis arrived where I suddenly decided to use my own name instead of the fictional one.
And was that easy for you? Was that an easy transition?
I almost feel as though this is a bit like trying to work out continuity for Spider-Man or something. It's like, you know, when they keep changing the backstory, and they've introduced something that couldn't work then because he hadn't met Dr. Octopus at that time. So something doesn't work because of continuity.
So the book is not Omnibus, it's Alec Final Crisis.
So
I found in a couple interviews that you wrote, you use the word personal work a lot.
I'm avoiding saying comic book here because I think of the comic book as a completely different medium. I think of myself as an artist, and I just get on with it. I make it, you know, when I brought out the book, How to Be an Artist, somebody criticized it and said, well, don't you mean how to be a comic artist? I thought, no, to me as an artist, this is my art. If it looks like comic books, you know, that's neither here nor there. I'm telling the stories of my time, and this is the medium I'm using. And if you want to argue about what it's called, you do so. But I'm too busy getting it done. But too often I get distracted into these stupid arguments about what it is and where it fits in the larger culture of the world, And it really isn't something we should be thinking about. We should just be getting the work done, and the work will carve out its own place in the world, which I think is what's happening. I think we have arrived at a point where there is a great body of worthwhile comics culture, comics art, and it has a serious presence in the world.
You know what? I'd love to come back and wrap up with the blog. We talked a little bit about it. But in a way, you know, watching you get excited about it at the beginning was, you know, for me, what resonated was that you were kind of doing blogging before blogging even existed, especially through those anecdotal, you know, one or two pager strips.
I know what you mean, but blogging was almost the perfect medium for me. It was... And I launched myself into it, thinking of blogging as a serious literary form. To most people, it's not. But then, you know, most people are not artists or writers. But I set myself the challenge right at the beginning that I would say something. I would cause myself to say something interesting every day for an entire year. I was very enthusiastic about the idea of blogging as a new literary form. When I think of my works, you know, when I think, oh yeah, you know, I did that book. Then I did a year. Then there was the year of blogging. That's one of my favorite works. The year of blogging. A lot of people felt at the time that this was that I didn't think it was a waste, but people thought previously he would have done a comic out of this, but he's not doing that now. We've been robbed of a comic. Well, we haven't been robbed of the comic because I took some of the best anecdotes and I made little comics out of them. So you've got the thing in the end that you thought you were missing.
In the Situation Room of the White House because of the suicide bombing that killed those 8 CIA officers in Afghanistan.
It's such an amazing story. Double agents, bunker bombs, but I kind of feel it bumped another story off the news, which was also fascinating. And I was actually kind of hoping to talk to you about it. The drones being hacked by terrorists.
Well, I guess I'm about to blow your mind then, because at the time of the attack, there was a drone overhead. Drones are like a very sophisticated, all they are is a very sophisticated remote control airplane. And like most remote control airplanes, one of the things that's controlled from the ground is the flight characteristics of the plane, right? You make it go left, right, climb, dive, that kind of thing, right? You control the flight. The second thing is that they have sophisticated camera systems on them, and those are also controlled from the ground. All these are controlled via radio signals. In the case of the drones that we have over the battlefield in Afghanistan, they also are equipped with missiles, and so that is also controlled. You can fire missiles, so you control the flight, the video, and the missiles from the ground. And so when the media reported about the hacking of the drones, what was going on was the insurgents had figured out a way, using commercial software apparently, to intercept and view the video feed that was coming from the drones. And so they could tell what we were looking at through the drones. That's what they meant by hacking the drones. And on the night of the 30th, when this attack happened, maybe they used it to help them plan the attack. We don't know for sure that the video system was compromised, although I'm pretty convinced, because what we do know for sure is that the flight system was hacked. The drone just took off on its own. As you can imagine, this kicked things up 100 notches. I mean, we have now have a situation where an armed drone is out of our control.
Oh my God.
I don't see how it can get any worse than this until it does. The signals all go dead and we lose our contact with the aircraft. We're not receiving signals anymore. It stopped transmitting.
Okay, I can understand it getting hacked, but how do you lose track of it? I mean, it's your armed drone.
All we had was just a bird out there somewhere, which is very small, designed not to be seen by radar. So we lost it. It was a lot like the movie Apollo 13 when they're trying to bring the astronauts back. It was just all hands on deck. We were trying to do anything we possibly could to figure this out. And about 10 hours later, we get this incredibly weak signal on the SATCOM network. Now, our SATCOM, that's the satellite communications network. That's like this sky grabber on steroids. I mean, if there is a radio signal out there, it locks on and finds it. So this signal pops up. It's got the same signature as the drone. Got an identification number. We know what it is. We're getting the video feed from a drone. We pull it up on the screen, and somebody in the room just gasps and says, "Oh my God, this thing is over Tel Aviv." So we've just got no warning. Like, bam, the video feed comes on. This thing is over Tel Aviv. And although we're trying to raise the Israelis, I just feel like we're frozen. We're just like watching a slow-motion car wreck that we can't prevent. It passes over the Army headquarters, passes over major utilities, power company, etc. It gets to the coast, right at the Mediterranean. And it turns north. And at this point, we're confused. You know, we're wonder what are they looking for. Someone yells, you know, are there any ships in the area? Maybe the target is a ship. And we're just watching this thing, and we're completely befuddled. Now, I need to stop here and explain something to you. Nudity at beaches in Israel is not normally accepted. However, there is one beach that has women-only days where they're allowed to go topless. That beach is called Metzitzim Beach. This drone flew from Afghanistan to Israel to Metzitzim Beach to spy on topless Israeli women. Breast, zoom in, bigger breast, zoom out, pan right, ass, zoom in. Look at the ass, back out, over here, more breasts, zoom in, zoom out. And this just kept going on and on. So now, in the control room, it's like that scene in Apollo 13, except everyone is huddled around monitors watching topless women at Metzitzim Beach. The official story is that the Israeli jets did what they were supposed to do. They scrambled, they got to the beach, and they blew this thing out of the sky. But that's not what I saw. The video feed started to pan back and forth really rapidly as if the plane was actually shaking. You ever see like two kids battling over a Wii game? I think that that's basically what happened. I imagine that you got a couple of guys that are in a basement somewhere in Dubai or Yemen or Syria, and they're got control of this drone, and they've been zooming in on boobs, and now they're starting to fight about who gets control, who wants to zoom in on what, They're pulling on this joystick and stuff back and forth. They lose control of the drone, and it crashes into the ocean.
But what about the missile system? Do you think they hacked the missile system too?
Oh, of course. Of course they did. They just didn't care.
Peep culture is basically the evolution of pop culture. So I argue that we are kind of in the next wave of pop culture. The original pop culture involved us watching celebrities going about their kind of preordained talent, where we are now much more interested in celebrity divorces and celebrity babies and celebrity drug problems and celebrity, you know, mansions than we are in what they're actually performing. So we're more interested in their daily lives, and this has sort of spilled over into being more interested in everyone's everyday life as a kind of a pop culture, as the new pop culture. What's wrong with us? You know, we're just as interesting, and I think that's proven to be true. We are entertaining each other through our own everyday lives, so that every snapshot you take, every time you brush your teeth, every choice of restaurant or experience at the grocery store suddenly has value. And this value comes from eyeballs who are watching you. It comes from social interactions that you now can put a premium on. Followers, so-called friends, people who are commenting on your blog. So there's a value there. Hey, people are noticing me. They're paying attention to me. And then it even has a financial value. We're reaching the point where people are starting to get paid to say that they brushed their teeth with Crest last night, you know? And then there's this kind of whole world of hey, you tell us everything you do, buy, watch, and we'll give you something back. And that might be something as simple as a Facebook page, a place to put all these thoughts out there, or it might be something like points. As we see with everything now has a reward system. So you shop at this grocery store, fly this airline, rent these cars, stay at these hotels, and you receive points. And in exchange, you are supplying information about your everyday life. The commercialization of it is in some ways overshadowing it, and also the way in which we move so quickly into turning ourselves and other people into entertainment product. Well, you know, this kid is great, but it would be better if this kid was trapped in a balloon. That shift has consequences. What shocks me is how quickly social mores are changing, and how quickly people really are saying, you know what, I don't care if everyone is watching me. I don't care if a corporation or a bunch of corporations are tracking my every move, as long as I get what I think I want out of it. And those changes are shocking, you know. And like, I don't care if there's a camera on every street corner. That's great. I'm into that, you know, because that's going to make me feel safer. And as a byproduct, it could generate some quality entertainment moments. I might see myself on TV being confronted by a robber, you know. So there's this incredible change in how people perceive things like privacy, people's perceptions of things like surveillance, people's attitudes toward what they're willing to kind of publicly put out there. And there's also this, another kind of really shocking thing is the way people will say, oh, you know, it doesn't matter all these scandalous details that can be accessed about me, and it doesn't matter because everyone's doing it and no one's going to use it against me. You know, that's just sort of the new normal, and people really believe that, and I say to them, it only appears to be the new normal because not everyone is doing that stuff, and when it comes time to apply to college or to apply for a job or to go before the judge, they will use that to make decisions about what kind of person you are. It would be foolish of them not to. People are really kind of blasé about this, and they sort of want to believe what they want to believe. They want to believe that they can kind of turn their lives into these micro celebrity commercial properties, get all these benefits, but not have to deal with the negatives. And celebrities have been dealing with the negatives, for decades. We've seen the negatives of what happens when every aspect of your life becomes available for public consumption. You go crazy. You become very disconnected from real life. Things that you thought were private emerge into public and come to mark you, and you can never get away from them. So it really, there's a lot of shocking, interesting things about this. The least shocking of it, I think, is that people are enticed to participate. Because it's kind of like, well, what have we been telling people for the last 100 years? Pretty much, celebrity matters. Well, the only thing that really represents success in society is celebrity and the acquisition of a lot of attention from a lot of people. So, we can't just keep telling people that, and then once they have an opportunity to sort of try some of this stuff out for themselves, they're going to, And I want to taste celebrity, and you want to taste celebrity, and anyone I've ever met wants to taste it. And people will say, I don't want it, but I don't believe them.
This episode of Too Much Information is called The Inferior Mirage. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, Bill Bowen, and Laura Mayer. It featured Hal Niedvieski, Peter Choice, Jessica Schrader, Jonathan Marston, Eddie Campbell, and our TMI Washington correspondent, Chris. For even more information, visit the TMI show page at WFMU.org. And that's where you can also subscribe to the TMI podcast.
Join us at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up now, For the Record, with Dave Emery.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 327, titled, Were We Controlled? This is being recorded on September 23rd of the year 2001. The title of this program is a direct nod and, under the circumstances, a respectful and affectionate ripoff of, affectionate probably the wrong word, but a respectful and altogether self-conscious ripoff of the title of a very rare book that was published in 1967, dealing with, among other things, the role of mind control and also the factor of stock market manipulation in the assassination of President Kennedy. We're going to get to the substance of that book. The book, again, called Were We Controlled? It was authored by someone who wrote under the name of Lincoln Lawrence. This, however, is apropos of the events surrounding the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th of the year 2001. We're going to begin this path of inquiry, and this, like so many of the programs that I've done, is frankly speculative in nature. We're going to be taking a look at some events which appear to have been attendant upon the terrorist blitzkrieg of 9/11/2001, and we're going to ruminate about the apparent manipulation of the capital markets vis-a-vis the terrorist attack, with the apparent manipulation of the capital market that took place with regard to the assassination, or in connection with, I should say, the assassination of President Kennedy. I have stated in some of my ruminations concerning the terrorist attack of September 11th that, in my opinion, and this will come as no surprise to longtime listeners, the executive authority in that attack was what I call the Underground Reich, and from an economic standpoint, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. It would be impossible, given the limitations of time, to do justice to what I mean by both of those. But when I talk about an Underground Reich, I mean quite literally a Third Reich that went underground and has perpetuated itself in a political and highly effective fashion, using the enormous wealth that was at its disposal, plus using the putative discipline of the SS, which remained largely intact at the end of World War II, and using the profound connections between the Underground Reich, the SS, the intelligence organization of former Gestapo chief Heinrich Mueller, and intelligence services of various countries around the world, including and especially the United States. This has permitted the Underground Reich to perpetuate itself and to expand its influence in an altogether remarkable and deadly fashion. As I've said before, it is my expectation, it's not something I endorse, but it is my expectation that ultimately the Bormann Organization and the Underground Reich will prove to be the decisive elements in human affairs on this planet, and I'm afraid that barring a sea change, they will prove the future is going to be theirs. By way of making a point that I have made in the past in connection with Paul Manning's research, a banker familiar with the Bormann Organization called it the most important concentration of money power under a single control in world history. The estimate by British intelligence of just the amount of money looted from occupied Europe minus what the Third Reich took from the Soviet Union and Greece was $143 billion, that's B as in billion dollars, and that's in early 1940s dollars. That's not including what they had before, the recapitalization of Germany under the Marshall Plan, and everything that they have earned since. And that is a phenomenal sum of money. It is, quite simply, the greatest concentration of economic power under a single control in world history, and when one combines that consummate power with the deadly expertise of the Heinrich Mueller organization, to which, among other institutions, the Reinhard Galen spy outfit that worked for the CIA and later the Federal Republic of Germany reported, one is dealing with a truly awesome, albeit underground and largely unrecognized, engine of power. And I believe, perhaps incorrectly, that it was that engine of power that was behind the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th of 2001. This is an event that many people have quite predictably oversimplified. Some have said that, the views have been predictable. Frankly, elements of the so-called progressive sector have been not only predictable but frankly un-American in their assessment of this, blaming it all on U.S. imperialism and saying that, we now are kind of getting our just desserts, which is frankly a shocking approach to take. Then you have the right-wing cowboy approach, wanted dead or alive, and this, that, and the other thing. This is not Tombstone territory. And then the conspiracy crowd have been saying, well, it was the government that did it. And there is an element of truth to that, but it's not the government that did this, but rather it is an element that is in control of the government. And I think an operational paradigm for people familiar with the intelligence community, with the Iran-Contra scandal, and with the, quote, struggle against terrorism, unquote, that has served as a rubric and a cover for a lot of other things, really as a cover for a lot of other things. The bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, it would be a good operational paradigm in which some elements of U.S. military intelligence, particularly the McKee team, had allegedly come across the connections between the Iran-Contra team and terrorist and weapons trafficker and drug dealer extraordinaire Manzar El-Kassar. And according to at least the insurance investigators' report, their discovery of the connections between Manzar El-Kassar and the Iran-Contra team led ultimately to their destruction on board Pan Am 103. The insurance investigators' report has been roundly disputed, but to the point being that there are elements of our own intelligence system which are in bed with the underground Reich and by extension with elements such as those that I believe committed the act of September 11th, and there are others that are sincerely opposed to that. With that rumination and a bit of editorialization on my part, let's proceed to the substance of the discussion. I think in many ways is the key to the September 11th terrorist blitzkrieg concerns the stock market manipulation, and it is my opinion that in all likelihood, if one follows the tendrils of that manipulation to where they would lead, one would come to the Borman Group. We're going to begin our analysis, and again, I want to stress that this broadcast is speculative in nature. We're going to begin our analysis with a look at the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, September 18th of 2001. This is an article by Christian Bertelsen of the Chronicle, last name Bertelsen. It's headlined, Airline Stock Deals Under U.S. Probe. It's subtitled, Investors Bet Against United and American.